The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. The spending of the Democrats creates an economic crisis.
The problem with inflation is that once it's out there, it's very hard to rein in except through a great deal of pain.
The president promises the middle class won't get hit by increased taxes.
Joe Biden's statement is obviously false.
Hillary Clinton explains the fallout of pulling troops out of Afghanistan.
The potential collapse of the Afghan government and a takeover of Afghanistan by the Taliban.
And a woman berating a policeman goes viral.
And I'm perfectly legal, and I'm a teacher. So there.
Congratulations.
You're a murderer.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my own radio program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. Follow me, please, on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. My podcasts are available everywhere that podcasts are. And follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. When Democrats debated during the primaries, they battled each other over who would spend the most money. Each promised an absurd amount of spending, knowing they'd back off in the general election. It's a tendency in both parties, playing to their base in the primaries, heading towards the middle once someone has secured the nomination. The Democrats were being honest in those early days. The spending push is beyond anything in our lifetimes, just as they promised. New York Times columnist Brett Stevens details the danger in Biden's latest effort in a piece titled Biden's Plan Promises Permanent Decline. He joined me this week on the Hugh Hewitt Show. President Biden, writes Brett, charts a course towards the largest expansion of government since Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. After signing a $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief bill in March and proposing a $1.5 trillion discretionary budget in April, a 16% increase from this year, on top of that, what's likely to be $3 trillion in mandatory spending on programs like Medicare and Medicaid, the president wants $2.3 trillion more for infrastructure and $1.8 trillion for new social programs. That's $7.5 trillion in discretionary spending. To put a number in perspective, we spent $4.1 trillion in inflation-adjusted dollars over nearly 4 years to wage and win the Second World War. Brett, my hat is off to you. You're the first person who's managed to put this into terms that I think the average American. Bill Bennett says we have a numbers problem when we get to numbers this size. It's an astonishing amount of money. That's all he's doing. He is going to transform America by spending money.
Well, yeah, and transform it in a way that's irreversible, and that's the point I also make in the column, because it's one thing if, say, you want to spend a lot of money to put a man on the moon. Well, eventually the Apollo program is going to end, and you will have had a technical and a humanistic achievement, but that's over. But when you're spending on programs like universal pre-K or paid parental leave, those things never go away. So what ends up happening is that the government's share of our gross domestic product is going to grow something like a French-like proportion, which is close to 50% of GDP. If you add all those numbers up, coming around $8 or $9 trillion, our GDP is $21 trillion, and so that's close to 50%. And so that brings you into French territory, and it's worth taking a look at how things are going in France. And it turns out, it's not just, you know, joie de vivre and promenading along the Champs-Élysées.
Well, Brett, we have a cliche that came to life yesterday. Janet Yellen said the quiet part out loud. She said we're going to have to raise interest rates because inflation is here. That rocked the market. She walked it back. There's a couple of stories from the Wall Street Journal yesterday. Yellen says interest rates must go down. Yellen says interest rates must go up. Yellen says interest rates won't go up. I think inflation is a lock, mortal lock, as they say in the horse racing business, but mortal locks in the horse racing business don't always come What do you think is the consequence in the United States of this kind of spending, which is it's actually exponentially larger than anything we've ever seen outside of war, and it's even double what we saw inside of war?
Well, I've been saying for months that we're going to see major inflation in 2021. Some of my colleagues disagreed with me, but now I think it's almost indisputable. And the problem with inflation is that once it's out there, it's very hard to rein in except through a great deal of pain.
Following the pattern of every true blue Democrat, with increased spending comes increased taxes. But President Biden has assured us repeatedly that nobody making less than $400,000 a year will see their taxes go up. Could that possibly be true? I discussed the issue with Senator Tom Cotton.
The reason I'm bothering to do this is I keep hearing on the press, Biden's going to raise your taxes. Anybody making less than $400,000 a year will not pay a single penny in taxes.
Stop.
And we will not increase.
What do you make of that, Senator Cotton? What he intended to say and what he said and what is true?
Well, Hugh, obviously false on its face because they're about to institute a massive marriage penalty because that figure applies not just to individuals but to two-income households as well. But if you take a step back, all these taxes, of course, are going to hit working families in their bottom line. Sure, Joe Biden can raise taxes on businesses, but businesses are ultimately tax collectors, not taxpayers. They're just going to raise prices on consumers to cover those taxes. It's also going to be less jobs for their employees. So obviously less take home pay if you don't have a job as well. So Joe Biden's statement is obviously false.
It's false on its face. It's false on the details. It is also false in refusing to admit we have an inflation problem, Senator, and it has been recognized by everyone except the Federal Reserve and Joe Biden. It's real and it's a tax.
Yeah, Hugh, unfortunately, if you look at almost any commodity market, you can look at the lumber markets, oil and gas, things that are used in basic construction like copper or tar, consistently prices are going up. Sometimes in the case of lumber, prices are going up to record levels.
I believe the 2x4, I've been helping Dwayne in his backyard, 2x4s and 4x4s, they are 100% higher than they were a year ago. 100% higher in 1 year. That cannot be limited to timber.
Yeah. So, Hugh, lumber at the 1,000 board foot level, which is how these things are measured, are actually four times as high as they were last year at this time at the outset of the pandemic. Some of that is related to the closures of mills during the pandemic, but more of it is related to bad policy, Hugh. Look, there can be all the demand for lumber that you want from your builder or at Home Depot or Lowe's, but if mills can't turn logs into boards, you're not going to be able to meet that demand. And they can right now. The one reason they can't is because many mill workers can make more money staying at home thanks to the Democrats' spending blowout last month, increasing unemployment payments by another $400 a month until September, at a time the economy was already recovering. If you look at Joe Biden's tax increases, if they eliminate the stepped-up basis at death and if they treat death as a capital gains tax event, it will be devastating to the timber industry. There is no industry that is a better definition of a cash or a asset-rich cash-poor industry than timber. It takes 25 to 40 years from the time you plant a tree to the time you can harvest it and turn it into a piece of lumber. And if you change the long-term tax treatment for something like the timber industry, you simply discourage people from planting, growing, and harvesting trees, which ultimately hits households in their bottom line when they're trying to build a treehouse for their kids or add a deck to their home or build a new home.
Let's talk for a moment about the unemployment. I do not fault anyone for making economically rational decisions. And if, in fact, one can put more money into their household and their pocket and their kids by staying at home and collecting unemployment while doing a side gig that is not disqualified by law, I have no criticism of economically efficient decision making. I do have criticism of Congress that failed to anticipate that behavior, Senator.
Yeah, Hugh, again, the bill that was passed in March was totally unnecessary. You know, it was totally unlike the situation we faced last March with the CARES Act at the very outset of this pandemic. By March, it was more than clear that the economy was robustly recovering and people were getting back to work because we had vaccines in record-breaking times. None of this is happening because of Joe Biden and the Democrats' policies. It's happening in spite of those things. It's happening because we have vaccines that are allowing people to get back to normal. Democratic governors are finally reopening their states. And it was foolhardy to extend unemployment benefits at enhanced levels all the way through September.
Does the timber industry have an alliance or an association that is trying to inform senators what is going to happen if stepped-up basis goes away?
Well, Hugh, lobbyists have their own trade association. So, yes, it's safe to say that the timber industry has a trade alliance as well, and they are undertaking that education effort. You know, they've worked for years and years to try to help senators and congressmen, mostly Democrats, understand the devastating impact the estate tax has had on our timber industry, especially locally owned timber industries as opposed to multinationals. But when you eliminate the stepped-up basis, which is, you know, the owner of a timber industry passes on and the children inherit it at current market value, not what the owner valued it at 50 years ago when he inherited it or when he started it. And then when you treat death as a capital gains event, so think about that. You die and you hold an asset, often a very illiquid asset, like a tree that's got to grow for 40 years. You say, okay, you got a tax on the gain that's been locked up in that asset. That really is just another kind of estate tax. And in some ways, it's worse than the estate tax because the exemptions are lower. And under the Biden plan, the rates would be even higher. You'd see what we see again time and time with the estate tax, which is locally owned timber industry or timber companies are selling out to multinationals. And that almost always means a loss of jobs. It certainly means a loss of community sports for things like the local Little League or the local Chamber of Commerce or the high school football scoreboard.
Steve Scalise, GOP whip in the House, and Alfredo Ortiz, who's the CEO of the Job Creator Network. They are a sponsor of this show. I always have to declare that. Join JCN.com. Both don't want to call it stepped up basis. They both say nobody understands that. It sounds like it's a millionaire's benefit. It's not. And Alfredo suggested calling it a success tax because it's going to hit small businesses as well as farms and timber businesses. It's just a disaster for the economy. And I can't believe Democrats are going to support that, Senator. I can't believe they're going to put that in the bill.
I hope they won't. I hope they won't. And it's important for all your listeners from all walks of life to understand just how devastating that tax would be for their communities. I mean, just think, Hugh, about a local diner. You know, if the land that diner's been sitting on for 20 or 30 years is appreciated in value, if you take the value of the diner's grills and its refrigerators and its freezers, all the other fixtures in the building, if you take the revenue that it generates, the goodwill it has, it could easily exceed the threshold for this tax, which means the little mom-and-pop diner that you've loved eating in for the last 20 or 30 years in your community has to be sold just to pay the tax man at death.
Coming up, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton surprised the White House with a troubling look at what will happen when our troops abandon Afghanistan.
The potential collapse of the Afghan government and a takeover of Afghanistan by the Taliban.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. President Joe Biden has promised to pull all United States troops out of Afghanistan by September 11, 2021. Despite the negative news regarding our time in that very difficult country, our presence there has had a profound impact. Women, for instance, and most obviously, long mistreated under the Taliban, are learning to read again and experience rights they hadn't dreamt of since the Kingdom of Afghanistan. Terrorism coming from that part of the world is greatly diminished. But is our job complete? Most would say no. Among them, Hillary Clinton and Condoleezza Rice, two notable secretaries of state, one for Barack Obama, the other for George W. Bush. Former United States Navy Admiral James Stavridis joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show to discuss. I would like to play a clip of former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton talking with Fareed Zakaria about the Afghanistan withdrawal and then get your commentary.
You know, there are consequences, both foreseen and unintended, of staying and of leaving. The president has made the decision to leave. And I think that our government has to focus on two huge consequences. One, the potential collapse of the Afghan government and a takeover of Afghanistan by the Taliban, probably with a resumption of civil war in certain parts of the country, but a largely Taliban-run government at some point in the not-too-distant future. How do we help and protect the many, many thousands of Afghans who worked with the United States and NATO, who stood up and spoke out for women's rights and human rights? I hope that the administration, in concert with the Congress, will have a very large visa program and will begin immediately to try to provide that channel for so many Afghans to utilize so that they are not left in danger. There will also be, I fear, a huge refugee outflow. And of course, the second big set of problems revolves around a resumption of activities by global terrorist groups, most particularly Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. And I agree with a recent article that you've written, Fareed, that, you know, we've seen a really sharp drop in both capacity and action on behalf of Islamic terrorist groups. I don't think, though, we can count on that staying in a downward spiral if the Taliban continue to provide refuge to international terrorist groups. And sadly, ever since George W. Bush asked them, all the way up to the efforts at negotiation in the last months of the Trump administration, the Taliban has never been willing to separate itself from Al-Qaeda. And we know that the current head of Al-Qaeda, who had been bin Laden's deputy, al-Zawahiri, is still somewhere in Afghanistan and Pakistan, biding his time. And so I think these two huge sets of issues have got to be addressed. I mean, it's one thing to pull out troops that have been, you know, supporting security in Afghanistan, supporting the Afghan military, leaving it pretty much to fend for itself. But we can't afford to walk away from the consequences of that decision.
All right. So, Admiral, your response as someone who formerly commanded the NATO deployment there.
I agree with Secretary Clinton, and I think her concerns are well placed. First of all, a key is going to be whether or not, and I hope we do, fund the Afghan security forces going forward. They're the ones fighting. That's why we haven't had a combat death in 14 months. They've had a lot. We still have a big contractor presence in that country, probably close to 20,000 contractors. Some of them will leave because they're supporting the U.S. military, of course, but a lot of them are there doing humanitarian work. A lot are doing intelligence work. We have to protect our embassy. And then third and finally, Hugh, I think an important point to be made is the overall strategic value of Afghanistan as a location. So having access to get into Afghanistan, even when the troops are not permanently there, will be important so that we can come in and stomp out any remnants of the Islamic State that flare up so that we can have a presence there on that very important strategic border next to Russia and China. So I agree with Secretary Clinton, and there's three additional points I would make.
A recent video went viral of a woman in a car who berated a Hispanic policeman who'd pulled her over. And he handled the confrontation with remarkable professionalism. If not for the body cam he was wearing, nobody would have known his side of the story. Here is Salem host Mike Gallagher.
This woman's actions are so horrifying. And it's another validation of how calm and professional and composed police officers are. Because how this guy didn't lose his cool is beyond me. It's infuriating to watch. And then even more infuriating is this woman evidently has a history of doing this, and she filed a complaint about the officer after the encounter. This is the entire exchange. It's worth noting that evidently the police officer is Hispanic. The motorist, the woman, is black. Listen to this exchange as we talk about race and racial relations in America.
You know why I'm being harassed today? Because I was going under the speed limit. I was going at 38.
Yes, you are, ma'am. Good morning.
Which is, and the speed limit is 40, and I was going 38, so why are you harassing me?
You are correct. I pulled you over because
You're a murderer.
Because
yes, I started to record because you can't you're a murderer.
You can't be on your cell phone while you're driving.
I wasn't on my phone. I was recording you because you scared me.
You can't use your cell phone while you're recording.
I can record you.
May I have your driver's license?
It's at my apartment.
What's your apartment?
It's at my home. I'm just taking my son to his.
Do you have your driver's license?
I mistakenly left it at home.
Do you have a picture of your driver's license?
Yes, I do.
May I have it?
And can you call your supervisor, please?
I already did. He's on his way.
Good, because you're a murderer.
Okay.
And so you're giving me a cell phone ticket? Is that why you're harassing me?
Not harassment. Yeah. I am enforcing the law.
I have a right to and record the police when they're harassing me.
By all means, but you can't do it while you're driving.
I wasn't texting or none of that.
Do you have that picture?
You scared me and made me think you were going to murder me.
Okay, well, I'm sorry you feel that way.
Well, that's not just a feeling. You're a murderer.
Okay. Can you zoom in on that for me,
Jay? Sure.
Thank you.
And I'm perfectly legal, and I'm a teacher. So there.
Congratulations.
Murderer. You're a murderer.
What's your last name? I can't see that there.
Well,
if
here you
stop,
go, murderer.
Stop shaking. Zoom in on that for
no,
me,
No, because
ma'am.
You're scaring me. You're threatening to kill me and my son. Can you give me
okay.
the...
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. You keep smiling.
Yeah,
you're on camera.
You're trying to threaten to kill me. I'm not smiling. You're the one who's... Crazy.
Hold that still. I can't see that. Is this your car?
Yes, it is. You're trying to say I stole my own car because you're jealous?
Yeah,
is that what
I don't
that's
think
about?
So. You wait for me right here, okay?
You're jealous.
Citation. All you need is your signature. He's only citing you for using your cell phone while you're driving. That's it.
There you go, ma'am. Sign inside the red box right there.
For him being a Mexican racist. What is that name? Gasco.
It's on the citation, ma'am.
Here you go, Mexican racist. You're always going to be a Mexican. You'll never be white. You know that, right? You'll never be white, which is what you really want to be.
There you go, dear. Have a good day.
You want to be white so bad.
Telling a Hispanic police officer, you know you're never going to be white, right? You're a Mexican. You're a murderer. Apparently her kid was in the car. What do you think that child is going to be like as that child grows up?
Coming up, big cities are losing good cops.
More than 200 Seattle police officers walked off the job last year, according to the Seattle Police Department.
Larry Elder, when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For more information, go to publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Even police who save lives are finding themselves the target of activists who simply don't like cops. Many of you are familiar with a recent tweet from basketball star LeBron James saying ominously, "You're next," with the picture of the policeman who shot one girl while she was attempting to stab another. This sort of culture is leading many policemen and women to simply find other lines of work. Here's Salem host Larry Elder.
Now, you recall the police officer who mocked LeBron James? Here again is what caused this officer to be suspended.
Dispatch, I've arrived at that disturbance. Will you have LeBron call my cell phone right away, please? Thank you. Excuse me, sir. Excuse me. No, can you put the knife down, please, sir? Sir, no, sir, don't stab it. No, stop, stab. Stop. Oh, hold on. It's LeBron. LeBron, hey, yeah, it's me again. Listen, I'm out here at this disturbance call, and there's a guy trying to stab another guy with a knife. What do you think I should do? Why does that matter? Okay, well, they're both black. One guy's trying to stab another guy with a knife. Deadly force is completely justified. Uh-huh. I see. So you don't care if a black person kills another black person, but you do care if a white cop kills a black person, even if he's doing it to save the life of another black person? I mean, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but then again, you are really good at basketball, so I guess I'll take your word for it. All right. Yep. Okay. All right. Thanks, LeBron. Michael Jordan's the GOAT. What? Nothing. I gotta go. Sorry, guys. You're on your own. Good luck.
That's a Bellevue, Idaho deputy marshal named Nate Sylvester. And as I said, he was punished. Exact punishment not disclosed, but so far a GoFundMe page set up in his honor has generated $200,000. He says he's going to use the money to make more videos. The Bellevue Marshal's Office said, quote, the statements do not represent Bellevue Marshal's Office. The Bellevue Marshal's Office always demands that our deputies engage with our citizens in a friendly and professional manner. This is not how we expect our deputies to act on duty or use city time. This is a personnel issue that is being dealt with internally, end of quote. Speaking of the police, Chandler, Arizona, police officer killed. I think last year there were 50, 60 officers that were shot and killed, others killed other ways in the line of duty. Just in case you haven't heard about this story, one more time, more police officers are killed every year than are unarmed blacks. New York Post, April 28, NYPD cop fatally shoots self inside New York City apartment. Officer Rory Dayhill, 34 years old, discovered by the police inside his town apartment after he failed to show up for work. Joined the department in 2013. Good guy, wonderful guy, officer's father told the Post. Suicide is believed to be the second NYPD this year, the other occurring earlier this month. In 2019, 10 cops took their own lives. NYPD cops did, double the rate of past years. Crisis has led the department to create a confidential suicide prevention program called Finest Care. And large numbers of officers are resigning from police departments all over the country in the wake of the Ferguson effect and the accusation that they are systemically racist. One cop says after people have put in their 20 years, a lot of people feel that haven't been sued, shot, or divorced, I'm getting out of here. The police are defunding themselves, according to this article in Philadelphia Weekly. It's a headline. Philly cops are defunding themselves. Subheadline, demoralized stat show police are quitting their jobs in record numbers. Quote, more Philadelphia police officers have put in for drop this past year than in any year in the past decade, except for one, which indicates deep dissatisfaction in the ranks, writes the Philadelphia Weekly. In 2020, 135 officers filed for retirement, trailing only the 159 who put in 2018. However, the 114 cops who put in their papers in January 2021 alone, a number that is greater than the total for most years. Combination of 2020 and January 21 is a record 249. And if January is any kind of indication about the rest of the year, this article says in Philadelphia Weekly, it will shatter all records. That's Philadelphia. Seattle, more than 200 Seattle police officers walked off the job last year, according to the Seattle Police Department. It has been described as, quote, a record pace, close quote. Recall the black female chief resigned last summer, said the budget cuts and the anti-police rhetoric left her feeling as though her department were, quote, destined to fail, end of quote. By the way, the city's homicide rate, 50% higher in 2020 than it was in 2019. Washington Examiner has this headline, NYPD experiences mass exodus of police officers, 75% spike in departures and retirements. In 2020, more than 5,300 NYPD officers retired or quit their positions, a 75% increase from the previous year. End of quote.
For more on that discussion from Larry Elder, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up.
On the eve of World War II, the New York Times had run a story claiming that Poland had invaded Germany.
The Gray Lady is in trouble once again when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The New York Times has had some great decades and some troublesome decades. They've had some of the best writers in journalism, and they've fired some of the best writers in journalism. In the past couple of years, the New York Times seems once again to be drifting into a dangerous direction. Ashley Rendsburg wrote the book, The Gray Lady Wink, How the New York Times Misreporting, Distortions, and Fabrications Radically Alter History. He discussed the past and the present with my friend and colleague, Dennis Prager.
What prompted you to write this book?
Well, the book grew out of a chance occurrence when I was kind of thumbing through a copy of William Shirer's great book of history on World War II, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. And in a footnote, Shirer just kind of noted almost casually that on the eve of World War II, the New York Times had run a story claiming that Poland had invaded Germany, which was, I was sitting in my chair and it just kind of almost, you know, knocked me out of the chair. It was such a crazy idea that the New York Times could print something that was so wrong. It was so opposite to what we know is the truth about World War II. It was fundamental. And that launched me on a mission to understand how that happened, why that happened, what else happened like that. And that eventually evolved into a full book.
Well, I remember reading that in college, by the way. It is one of the most riveting works of history I have ever read. And I think it stands up in time, don't you?
I absolutely do. And not only his books stand up, but his journalism does too. And that was really important, something that I went back and looked at how other journalists, how other news outlets were covering events like World War II. And, you know, because it's easy to say, well, looking back, it's 2020, very nice of you, you did your research, great. But the reality was that people like Shirer or Edward Murrow, they were reporting very much correctly. They were reporting on things like World War II or the Holocaust or many other events in history that the Times completely botched. These guys got it right, and the Times got it completely wrong. So it wasn't just about hindsight.
The New York Times actually reported that Poland invaded Germany and not the other way around?
Yeah, so the lead story on that day in 1939 was basically a reprint of Nazi propaganda.
Yes, that's what the Nazis claimed. That's right. They were responding to a Polish invasion.
Exactly. And it wasn't by chance, of course. These were very well-seasoned propagandists, the Nazis. And they decided they would launch the war by deceiving the world as to the fact. That would give them enough time, enough credibility. It would confuse the story enough to create a pause. And that's all they needed. As we know, they were one of their biggest strategies was using the blitz, move fast, storm. And just having the space of a few days where people said, oh, okay, well, if the Polish, these insurrectionists actually did invade this German border town, then maybe the Germans are right to invade Poland. It kind of makes sense. And that's exactly what the Nazis wanted. But it all depended on getting this out into the world. And having it printed on the front page of the New York Times was, I would say, qualified as out.
Okay. So that footnote sort of triggered this whole thing in you?
Yeah. I think a lot of people like myself at the time and still today have a sense that something is up. When you read certain stories or coverage in the mainstream media, you get a sense that you're not getting the full picture. In my case, I had been living in Israel. I still live in Israel. And I saw the Times reporting here, and I saw the reality on the ground here. And I said, there's just no way to reconcile these two things. The reality is so divergent from what I'm reading in this illustrious newspaper. How can it be? And when I saw this little footnote in William Shirer's book, I said, okay, there's something more here. There's something going on. And when I discovered what happened throughout the Times' coverage of World War II over the course of a decade, that's when I started to understand that feeling that I had that something was amiss was actually real. It was what we called, you know, almost like being gaslighted when you discover, aha, it's not me, it's them.
Well, of course, it began even before the 1939 German invasion, because they got the Pulitzer Prize for denying that the Ukrainians were having a famine.
Yes, definitely, definitely. That was at least on the same level, the same proportion as their coverage or their botched coverage of World War II, which is that famously a reporter named Walter Duranty covered up the Ukraine famine. He denied it in his reporting. He was, I would say, the most famous English language reporter in the world at the time. He was a brilliant person, spoke five languages, Oxford educated. And the Times' narrative still today is that he was kind of a rogue reporter. He was slovenly. They really pinned it on him. But that isn't the story. Duranty knew very well what was going on in Russia and Ukraine. He was there. He was on the ground. He was very well connected. He covered it up, it turns out, because he was instructed to. You know, the question is, why would Duranty do this? Why would he risk his whole career, his journalistic reputation, to peddle such a big lie? I mean, the Ukraine famine was big news. It was a big story. And if you're a journalist, you want that story. You don't want to cover up the story. You don't want to make it seem as if there's no story. So that's the question. Why did he do it? And it's a question no one really asks. And the answer to it is because the New York Times' ownership wanted it to be told in this way, because they were pushing for American official recognition of the USSR. This was the early days of the Soviet regime. And you could not convince the American public that the government should recognize this regime if it had just killed 2 to 3 million of its own people. It turns out the number was actually much greater than that, but that's what was known at the time. And they buried it for that reason, and it worked.
Given its record of lying, how did it become known as the paper of record?
Up until that point, the paper had been very well respected and quote-unquote gray. I mean, that's where the name The Gray Lady comes from, is that the reporting was pretty down the line. The founder of the dynasty, I was a German-Jewish immigrant to America. He loved America and appreciated all that it had done for him. His name was Adolf Fox. And he decided that he would report the news without fear or favor. That's his famous proclamation. He wrote it in the New York Times as a business announcement, and he kept to his word. But, you know, this is the nature of a dynasty, is that the founder might have great intentions and good ideals and good values, but what happens with a dynasty, this is something we see over and over in politics and media and business, is that the rest of the dynasty down the line are more interested in maintaining or growing their wealth and their power and their prestige than they are in fulfilling the original ideals of the founder. And that's exactly what's happened at the Times. And we lose sight of it. We think of this as just a newspaper, but it's not. It is an institution, a business, and a company that controls how we perceive the world. It controls how we understand what's going on around us. And that is a lot of power for a very small number of people.
For the rest of that discussion, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up, Facebook continues its ban of Donald Trump.
That's the only way they can function. They can't function in a democracy where issues are debated.
The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt when we return.
If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, kids in public schools continue to pay a heavy price in the pandemic. And the CDC is playing right along.
That's exactly from the teacher union playbook.
President Biden puts forward a spending plan for education that is absolutely massive.
The price tag for the education portion alone was $748 billion with a B.
If he's successful, his plan for government-funded child care would do far more harm than good.
And that's what this amounts to, a government takeover of a great deal of the nation's business in raising children.
And as corporations got woke, the shareholders are the last line of accountability.
You can force them to say something given their own policies.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Facebook banned former President Donald Trump from their platform after the January 6th insurrection. Now, a company-appointed oversight committee ruled this week that they were justified in the action of banning and recommended, however, that the company reassess in another 6 months. Joe Piscopo evaluated that decision with New York Post columnist Michael Goodwin. From AM 970, The Answer, out of New York City.
Apparently, Facebook is going to uphold the ban
of Donald J. Trump. It's Facebook. Do we really care? Where do they get the gall to be that powerful, sir?
I think that they view themselves as part of the protection against the vandals in society, and anybody who doesn't agree with them is a vandal. It's like the Goths are sacking the city, so the sackers are all, to them, Republicans, conservatives, Trump followers, Trump supporters, Trump himself. They have to be blighted out. They have to be canceled. They have to be silenced. That's the only way the Facebook, the big tech, the New York Times, CNN, that's the only way they can function. They can't function in a democracy where issues are debated. They can only have one view, and you must subscribe or you are canceled. We will use whatever power we have as a technology company to make sure you have no way to spread your thoughts. If I'm in the FBI and I feel the same way, well, I'm going to spy on you. So this is not a harmless thing that we're witnessing with big tech, because it is a manifestation of what we see in other elements of our society. We see it on college campuses. Yes. We see it in the media itself. And we see it in one of the two main political parties. There's a purity test.
And then the narrative, Michael Goodwin, it's like I always say, with Kamala Harris, her grandfather owned slaves. And you do your homework more than anybody, Michael. Correct me if I'm wrong. Kamala Harris's grandparents owned slaves. You and I go, okay, that was the grandparents. It's not Kamala. And we're not going to accuse her of anything. But yet they'll tear down Columbus statues. They'll take away Columbus Day for the Italian Americans. Where are we going to end up with? Do we have time to save this country is the question.
Oh, sure. I do. And I don't think we're at the end yet. We are now witnessing the ascension to power of this party and of these adherents of this party. I don't mean to blanketly condemn every Democrat. I'm actually a registered Democrat myself. But the socialist / communist / fascist wing of the Democratic Party is in ascendancy right now.
Thank you for joining the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Bouchon, Michael Cook, Alex Perez, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, Harley Idy, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.